continent of this debate show on Press TV. Let me thank our guests. We had from the Answer Coalition, Richard Icker out of San Francisco, and also we had author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, who joined us out of Washington, D.C.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين قوما ولا أنا ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: U.S. says it is discussing options with European allies to revive the Iran nuclear deal through a series of initial and mutual steps. The third day of the trial of the former U.S. officer charged with the murder of African-American George Floyd features devastating footage and an emotional testimony. Brazil registers yet another daily record of nearly 3,900 COVID-19 deaths and more than 90,000 new cases. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the U.S. says it's discussing options with its European allies to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal through a series of initial and mutual steps. The State Department spokesman says Secretary Antony Blinken explored the possibilities during meetings in Brussels last week. Ned Price says Washington remains committed to a joint return to the pact. Iran has rejected direct talks with the U.S. over the nuclear deal, Tehran says. It cannot trust Washington because it has reneged on its promises by withdrawing from it back in 2018. The pullout reinstated sanctions on Iran in response the country rolled back its nuclear commitments. Tehran now says all sanctions must be lifted in order for further steps to happen. We're now joined by author and commentator John Stepling, joining us from RISA. Mr. Stepling, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on the recent comments coming from the United States and whether Iran should buy into those comments at all.
Well, it's perhaps useful to look at a speech Joe Biden gave in early February. It was kind of introducing a bit of his foreign policy to people, and it's revealing about what his priorities are going to be. He said the war in Yemen must stop. This is a war that he was one of the chief architects in starting under Obama. But then he claims he doesn't hold the Saudis at all responsible and claims the Saudis are reacting to missiles fired from, you know, Iranian-backed operatives in Yemen. There's no evidence for any of this, of course, and it's another way of absolving Saudi war crimes. The U.S. isn't going to change its foreign policy. It is already bombing Syria. Whether it lifts the sanctions or not is an open question. The JCPOA is all but irrelevant at this point. The sanctions are the real issue, and Iran understandably wants those lifted. I don't think personally that's going to happen. Biden has appointed nothing except the most intense warmongering hawks that he can find. Anthony Blinken, of course, has a history of that. Burns at the CIA is an old school interventionist. All of these people are served in one capacity or another under Obama, nearly all of them. So we're going to return to Obama's second term. And that means drone assassinations and all kinds of COVID movement in that region. The U.S. troops are not coming home. U.S. sees Iran as occupying a very essential piece of geography, and they want to control that. They're not going to engage in a flat-out assault, but they are going to allow Israel and the Saudis to carry on whatever aggressions they feel are necessary. The Saudis, of course, are huge weapons purchasers from the U.S. And this is happening. The backdrop to this, of course, is the economic crisis in the U.S., and this is what Biden has to deal with right now. The creation of it was intentional. We've seen a monopolization of retail. We've seen 60 million jobs lost, and a transference of wealth, a further transference of wealth to the top, like 1% during this lockdown, this pandemic lockdown. It's been very profitable for certain people and certain kinds of businesses. So that's at some point going to have to be addressed, and we're seeing, you know, a further surveillance state intensified, vaccination passports, all these kinds of things, which are just elements of social control. So I think that Rouhani is right, and he should not trust the U.S. They've given no indication ever that they should be trusted, certainly not in dealings with the Iranian government. And Biden has also signaled his intentions elsewhere with the Bolivians, that he helped orchestrate the coup. The socialists have been voted back into power in Bolivia. Biden's already targeting that government. Same with Maduro in Venezuela. This is going to be his foreign policy. And I think Iran is right to be highly skeptical of any kind of pseudo-promises this administration makes right now.
All right, thanks a lot, Mr. Stepling. Author and commentator John Stepling joining us from RISA. Well, new footage is displayed during the third day of the trial of a former Minneapolis officer charged with the murder of George Floyd, which shows a black man pleading for mercy.
Man in the car!
I'm not a bad guy!
The video was captured by an officer's body-worn camera who was trying to apprehend Floyd. The footage was shown while prosecutors were questioning eyewitnesses. The witnesses included a cashier who received a counterfeit $20 bill from Floyd, an event that prompted the officers to make the arrest. The cashier said he believed Floyd didn't know the bill was fake. The harrowing videos caused one witness to break down in tears during his testimony.
I feel helpless. With the ball running out of his mouth.
The witness was reacting to footage that showed Floyd calling for his mother. The former policeman on trial is Derek Chauvin, who kneeled on Floyd's neck for just shy of 9 minutes. He's charged with manslaughter and murder charges. The black man's death sent shockwaves across the U.S., provoking an outcry against racial injustice in the country. U.S. Civil rights activist Life Malcolm believes George Floyd's murder trial can never be a remedy for African Americans who have been the main victim of police brutality and racism in America.
Right now, the government has to respond by using Derek Chauvin as some kind of scapegoat. But we know, African people and other people who stand on the side of oppressed people know that there's nothing that the government can't do to Derek Chauvin, even if they do find him guilty, that is going to rectify and remedy the oppression that African people have endured in this country. George Floyd's murder on May 25th of 2020 was just one example of the brutality that African people in this country face all the time. And make no mistake about it, the only reason why this is a big media scandal. It's not because the white people in the form of the police killed, white power in the form of the police killed an African. It's because he got caught on camera. And so he has to pay for, Derek Chauvin has to pay for being sloppy enough to get caught doing this type of thing that white power does to African people in this country all the time. So they're going to try to use him as a scapegoat, but there's no there's no remedy other than overturning the colonial oppression that we have in this country. It's going to take African people to do it. The United States government cannot redeem itself.
Police in the U.S. state of California have reported a shooting incident south of Los Angeles with multiple victims.
There are fatalities on scene. We do have 4 fatalities on scene. We do have 1 injured person who was transported to the hospital, along with our suspect who was also transported to the hospital.
Police in the city of Orange say officers responded to the shooting incident in the early hours of Wednesday. They say suspect has been arrested, but the motive behind the incident remains unclear. Police say the situation is now stabilized. Investigations show that the United States loses around 33,000 people to gun violence every year. Additionally, more than 100,000 people are shot there each year. Child hunger in the United States has jumped by 50% during the COVID-19 pandemic. While a poor social safety net is getting most of the blame, increasing consumer prices are putting food off the tables for many low-income families. Rami Mazari has more from Chicago.
Data from the United States Census has found that child hunger has soared 50% since the pandemic hit 1 year ago. Some of the biggest increases have been recorded in the nation's wealthiest communities, where the unprecedented demand for food aid has overwhelmed local authorities. Federal government has been consumed by political infighting as Congress only recently passed just the 2nd major household stimulus despite the prolonged economic devastation wrought by lockdowns.
The people in the U.S. just make so little money and food is becoming so expensive that, you know, people can't afford food. And this has increased since the COVID crisis. And there's nothing in the U.S. Bill of Rights which says you are guaranteed a right to food. So the federal government really doesn't care.
The surge in hungry children is another reminder of the human toll caused by the infamously weak social safety net and the cutthroat capitalist culture of the world's richest country.
Meanwhile, you have farmers in Western states, since really the trade war with China started, that you've seen like mass quick slaughters of animals that were for meat because they couldn't make a profit because they can't ship to China. Since the pandemic started, you've had videos of like farmers having to light their potato crops on fire. So there's enough food in the U.S. It's just the system's not set up to get it to people.
The lockdowns have caused supply chain disruptions in food production, leading to increased food prices, which show no sign of lowering. While corporations can sometimes navigate disruptions, small grocers and corner stores, which are usually the only place to buy food in poor American neighborhoods, are forced to pass higher costs on to their customers, usually low-wage workers who are least able to afford price increases. In February, the UN's food price index rose for the 9th consecutive month, reaching a level not seen since 2014, a year that saw major food riots in multiple developing countries. It's not just food prices which have inflated out of the reach of many recently. Gasoline prices are at their highest point in 6 years, up over 40% in the past 12 months. Home prices are soaring faster than in almost a decade, up 11% over the past year. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Brazil has reported nearly 3,900 new coronavirus deaths, setting another record for daily virus fatalities. The figure takes the overall tally to more than 321,000. The health ministry said more than 90,000 cases were also registered in the span of 24 hours. The official tally of infections in the Latin American country has crossed 12.7 million. Brazil recorded more than 66,500 fatalities in March, the country's deadliest month yet in the pandemic. The Latin American country is the second worst hit nation in the world after the United States in terms of both deaths and infections from COVID-19. And Ukraine has registered a record daily high of 421 new deaths from the pandemic. Thursday marks the second day in a row that Ukraine reported a record daily fatality toll. The health ministry also announced over 17,500 new cases and a record high of over 5,000 hospitalizations. Ukraine imposed a tight lockdown last month, which saw closures of cafes, restaurants, and non-food stores. In Germany, new COVID cases were over 24,000 and new deaths were 201 in the past 24 hours. The country has tightened restrictions since early this year. It has also put curbs for those coming to the country to contain the virus. Well, the United Nations has warned of a civil war and imminent bloodbath in Myanmar as the military crackdown on anti-coup protesters has left more than 500 people dead since February. UN envoy for Myanmar, Christine Schraner-Bergener, called on the Security Council to use all available tools to take collective action and prevent a multidimensional catastrophe. Bergener also said she remained open to dialogue with Myanmar's military junta, warning that the situation will only worsen if the UN waits for when they are ready to talk. Myanmar has been the scene of demonstrations since the military toppled and detained elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The army said the November 2020 elections won by Suu Kyi's party were fraudulent. And the Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has called on Saudi Arabia to end its war on Yemen, which has left thousands of civilians dead and most of the impoverished nation's infrastructure in ruin. Mariam Salah has more in this report from Beirut.
Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, urged Saudi Arabia to immediately end its war on Yemen and lift its blockade on its southern neighbor. Said Nasrallah called on Saudi Arabia not to waste time by proposing deceiving initiatives which lead to nowhere and stressed that stopping the war and the blockade should be simultaneous. Nasrallah also warned of a Saudi plot to blame Yemen's Ansarullah movement for the ongoing conflict in the war-torn country.
You need to stop the war and end the blockade. Then we can sit and negotiate. Here's where the deception lies. What does it mean if you stop the war without ending the blockade? It means that what they could not realize through a military war, they want to achieve through humanitarian and social pressure.
Elsewhere in his remarks, he said the U.S. is not as strong as before and is on a path toward collapse, while the axis of resistance is gaining power.
America is no longer the America that you knew. There is one main issue that Imam Khamenei has stressed in the last year, and I call on everyone in the region to ponder on that thought. That is the decline of the U.S. America is taking the downward path.
Speaking at an event commemorating late Sheikh Ahmad al-Zin, who was a pioneer in clerics who spoke for Palestine, Nasrallah stressed that the so-called deal of the century has died as a result of the Palestinian people's patience. Observers believe Sayyid Nasrallah's views shows that there is an opportunity for the entire region, even for the Saudis, to be able to stop the crisis of the war they launched on Yemen.
The speech of Sayyid Hassan shows that all regional sides enjoy an opportunity to hold on to their principles and at the same time preserve their achievements. This is true even with the issue of Islamic Republic of Iran and its nuclear program. All of these developments can pave the way for achieving political results.
Hezbollah leader also warned regional countries against relying on the United States. Hezbollah's leader then touched upon the political impasse in Lebanon, calling for the immediate formation of a new government.
Hezbollah's Secretary General has stressed in his speech that most of the wars in the region, namely in Syria or Yemen, are mainly aimed to target the resistance and the Palestinian cause and to create a Sunni-Shiite rift. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The trial of the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, has resumed in the northern Nigerian town of Kaduna. Danjuma Abdullahi has the details of the case.
The prosecution in Sheikh Zakzaki's trial finally completed the presentation of witnesses when the trial resumed in a Kaduna High Court, where the Islamic cleric is standing trial for culpable homicide and other charges, which he pleaded not guilty. The prosecution lawyer expressed the hope that he will get a conviction following the presentation of credible witnesses.
We presented about 15 witnesses for the prosecution. 15 top army generals that were key actors, key players in the whole of the saga that led to the filing of the charges against Balaam Sheikh Zakzaki. One of our prayers is that the court should overrule the no-case submission, overrule the defense, and convict the defendants accordingly and pass the necessary sentence as provided for.
However, Zazaki's defense team dismissed the claim of the prosecution as it affirmed an earlier position that there shouldn't even have been a case against the Islamic cleric. Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat have been in detention for over 5 years, despite the ruling of a federal high court ordering for their release. Over 340 of Sheikh Zazaki's supporters were killed, including three of his biological sons, when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center in December 2015. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat are detained in the Kaduna Correctional Facility, not far from this courthouse where the trial is taking place. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has just turned 70, and his supporters are calling for his immediate and unconditional release. Danjuma Abdullahi, Kaduna.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Islamic Republic Day, formation of religious popular rule. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Election is one of the principles for materialization of popular rule. This principle is very important in formation of popular systems. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the referendum for establishment of the Islamic Republic system of government was highly emphasized. This great move manifested the unique role of referring to the nation's votes and the real status of people's demand. Of over 40 elections in Iran in the post-election era indicates the importance of people's status in consolidation of popular establishments in the Islamic Iran. The first of these elections, and referring to people's vote, took place on April 1, 1979, less than 2 months after the resounding triumph of the Islamic Revolution. On this day, a referendum was held with the emphasis of Imam Khomeini for formation of the kind of the ruling system. This proved the high status of people's vote and demand for Imam Khomeini. Although the Iranian nation unanimously had shown their love for Islam and toppled the unpopular and dictatorial system through the unmatched leadership of Imam Khomeini, the Imam observed the highest degree of democracy by referring to the people's vote. Although, immediately after the victory of the revolution, he could announce the form of government as it had been announced through the struggles of the people as they used to chant in the demonstrations, independence, freedom, and Islamic Republic. Some of the ulema and influential revolutionary figures had proposed the declaration of the Islamic rule in Iran after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, but Imam Khomeini was opposed to them and insisted on holding a referendum for this end to make it completely lawful. However, the Imam mentioned his view on the form of government by saying, "This referendum will determine the fate of our nation. This referendum will take you either to freedom and independence or, like before, to suffocation and dependence on others. This referendum is what everyone should participate in. You can choose any form of government that you want. You are entitled and can write on this paper, Democratic Republic, Royal regime, or whatever you want. You are free in this." On April 1, 1979, the Islamic Republic system of government was shaped with an unprecedented 98.2% of the votes in favor of the Islamic Republic. In other words, nearly 100% of the voters dropped yes in ballot boxes. Thus, this day was named as the Day of Islamic Republic. Referring to people's vote is of high importance in Iran. As a matter of fact, all constituents of the ruling system are directly or indirectly elected by people's vote. It has been made clear in Iran's constitution that the Islamic Republic system is dependent on people's vote. On this basis, all parts of the power hierarchy are determined by people's vote and will. Article 56 of the constitution stipulates the principle of religious popular rule. The article reads, "The absolute rule on the world and man belongs to God, and God has assigned man to determine his own social fate. No one can deny man this divine right or put it at the service of a specific individual or group. and the nation exercises this God-given right through the ways that have been explicated in the next articles. In Iran, participation in elections is not a legal issue, but it is considered as a religious duty and part of the individual rights of people in society. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said in part of his speech on the 25th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing away in 2014, "In the model of the Islamic Republic, not only popular rule and religion are not separate elements, but popular rule stems from religion. Some individuals shouldn't think that our great Imam Khomeini adopted elections from the West and blended it with the Islamic thought and law. No, if elections, popular rule, and reliance on people's votes had not been part of religion and had not been taken, learned from the Islamic law, the Imam would not have any obligation, and that frank and decisive man would say it clearly. This is part of religion. The Islamic law should be observed, and the administration of affairs in this system is carried out by people. The affair is in people's hand. This is the main pillar of the great Imam's move." Ayatollah Khamenei, in his important statement known as the second phase of the revolution, has highly emphasized on elections for materialization of participation and political freedom. Religious popular rule is indeed materialization of people's rights in determination of their fate. The leader said elsewhere in his remarks, "The government's being popular means granting right to people in the government. It means that people play a role in administration of government, formation of government, and determination of the ruler. Another meaning of the Islamic government's being popular is that it is the service of people. What matters for the ruler are the public interests of people rather than certain persons, a certain stratum, or a certain class." Elections in the Islamic Republic of Iran have always consolidated the pillars of the ruling system, and that's why the enemies have tried by every hook and or every crook to distract people from the ballot boxes.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor. Now we kick things off here because positive vaccine sentiment in Britain, well, it's gone up by more than 90% since the start of the year. But as Saeed Poreza reports, a combination of conspiracy theories, the lack of trust in the government, and the healthcare system has led certain British communities to think twice about taking the jab.
The Beit al-Futuh Mosque in London, one of the largest in Western Europe, hosting a pop-up vaccine clinic to boost inoculation rates and overcome vaccine hesitancy amid the many myths that have been created around the pandemic.
NHS approached us and they said they with the idea of a pop-up clinic here, vaccination clinic, and you know, we welcomed it. Our community has had an abnormally high number of people that have suffered from the from the virus?
We dispel the myths about microchips and blood clots and answer their queries. Some are really concerned about their fertility.
British scientists say there is a historical trend of lower vaccine uptake in areas with a higher proportion of ethnic minority groups in England.
A recent study found that a high percentage of people from Pakistani or Bangladeshi origin said they were unlikely to be vaccinated. Among black Britons, the figure stands at more than 40%, the highest of all ethnic groups in this country, meaning that some of the most vulnerable people are the least likely to get the jab.
And that's a concern for the British government, which plans to inoculate every adult in the country with the first dose of the vaccine by the end of summer. Online videos distorting people's understanding of the virus and the vaccines abound. This one, that claims silver solution kills the virus, was proved false by a news channel. Conspiracy theories have deepened public distrust in medical science.
Well, I think there's been some indication amongst South Asians for the Indian community that there might be some element of beef in the vaccine, that it might be unsafe. Particularly, there's been these questions of whether there's any pork content, porcine content, pig content to the vaccine, which there is not. But those rumours have been going amongst the Pakistani community in particular, which is large in our country, and they are false accusations.
Among some black Britons, a sense of unease. They don't trust the government. Some fear there might be different vaccines for black and white people. This week, a video featuring high-profile black figures urging black Britons to take the vaccine.
But we're asking you to trust the facts about the vaccine from our own professors, scientists, and doctors.
Vaccine hesitancy also extends to ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities, mostly over fears it might contain pork. Or from the perspective of this controversial rabbi, popular on YouTube, it might alter people's sexual orientation. Conspiracy theorists exploit a lack of trust in the government and a health system that to some ethnic minorities appears to favor white people and the more affluent. The British government's challenge now is to build trust in the vaccines proven to save lives. Saeed Puriza, London.
Well, Dr. Bob Gill, who's the producer of the great NHS Heist, and of course, a practicing family GP. Now, why has the take-up been so low, Dr. Gill? I mean, we've heard some of the reasons here, but how are you finding it from your perspective?
Well, generally, my symptoms are very well. The vaccine, if we hear there's any hesitation amongst high-risk groups, then it will take the time to speak to individual patients and reassure them that the vaccine is safe. All my staff who are eligible have had the vaccine. I have had the vaccine. My wife's had the vaccine. And often when they hear these personal accounts and reassurance from a trusted health professional, that often helps get over the head.
Now, one of the major issues here is the misinformation being promoted online. How can that be combated?
It's very difficult. You know, it doesn't take long for lies to spread very widely, and often there may even be an element grain of truth, but things get amplified out of all proportion, and they pick up on individuals' mistrust of government, as your report very clearly outlined. And you know, we do know that society is not equal. There is discrimination out there in society, particularly, you know, with the hostile environment and how poor immigrant populations have been treated in recent years. So that trust has been eroded by government policy. But when it comes to healthcare, in particular the uptake in the vaccination program, we have to undo some of that damage, which has been, you know, well founded in terms of trust in government.
Now, we're hearing several reports that there are different European countries that are seriously considering implementing the vaccine passports for those who are thinking of international travel, of holidays, and so on. Do moves like this help or hinder the pro-vaccine message?
I think, in a way, governments may be using this as a stick in terms of limiting people's freedom to travel. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword. If you introduce some sort of passport system for vaccination, well, that may also indicate the thin edge of the wedge. You may start to introduce other health information which people would rather be kept private. And there is that argument that this might lead to creeping expansion of the amount of information we have to provide to travel. So I'm reluctant to support the passport idea, just because we don't know where this might end up. But I think we need to use every positive means to encourage people to take up the vaccine.
Dr. Bob-Gill, thank you, as always. Now, we stay here in the United Kingdom, where we begin with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who joined more than 20 other world leaders in calling for a new global treaty to help the world prepare for any future pandemics. In a joint letter published today in newspapers around the world, the leaders argued that the COVID-19 crisis had posed the greatest challenge for the global community since the late 1940s. In the letter, the leaders expressed hope that any future treaty would provide a more robust international health architecture that provides better protection for future generations. The document was signed by 24 signatories, including the head of the World Health Organization, in addition to leaders from across Europe, Asia, and Africa. The United Nations is urging international donors to pledge up to $10 billion to the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria, adding that the need for humanitarian support in the country has never been greater. The appeal comes on the same day as Tuesday's Brussels Conference on Syria, an annual event co-hosted by the UN and the European Union. Ahead of the event, UN aid chief Mark Lowcock stated that plummeting living conditions, economic decline and COVID-19 have resulted in more hunger, malnutrition and disease. Earlier this month, Syria marked its grim 10-year anniversary of the war. The foreign-backed conflict in Syria, which flared up in 2011, has so far claimed the lives of 500,000 people and has left millions more displaced.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert Inlakesh, we know that Riyadh is very keen to launder its reputation. We heard about sports washing, but this time using the environment in what some are calling a little bit of greenwashing. Tell me more.
Well, this is an interesting story. Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, is pledging that 10 billion trees will be planted in Saudi Arabia in a bid to tackle climate change, and on top of that as well, this factors into the 2030 plan that they put forth, which of course is supposed to gear Saudi Arabia to essentially move away from its dependency upon oil purely. But from the kingdom, what we have seen is that in an attempt to try and distract people, and specifically its critics, they have attempted to, like you said, sports wash and use things like this, now an environmental cause, in order to try and take attention away from the real issues inside of their kingdom. Namely, in this case, if we're talking about climate change, it's interesting that they're currently bombarding Yemen, and the airstrikes have only gone up since the U.S. Biden administration has came into power. That's not going to be good for the environment, yet we're seeing that these pieces are distributed. Even this piece that we pulled up was on the Independent. They're putting it out in, of course, a way which makes Saudi Arabia look good. When people see these headlines, people think that Saudi Arabia is moving towards progress, but that is not what we're seeing with Saudi Arabia. In fact, we're seeing that things like beheadings are on the rise, and of course, its bombardment and genocide, as it's been termed, inside of Yemen is only escalating.
Now, with some of the comments you mentioned there, is that being reflected online, Rob?
Well, the first comment we've got here, and an immediate reaction to this when the story came out, in fact, is from a Twitter user who says, "Make sure to name the forest Jamal Khashoggi. This guy is a criminal and dictator with innocent blood on his hands. We've got another one here as well who says, how does someone acquire 10 billion trees? More like 10 billion lies.
Right, we leave that there and we move to another story where you touch very briefly upon perhaps the impact of the Biden administration here in not stopping the situation in Yemen. Syria's now come up. What is Mr. Blinken, the new Secretary of State, saying?
Well, the Secretary of State hosted a meeting, a virtual meeting in the United Nations Security Council yesterday. And he sort of emerged as a heroic figure from it, at least if you were to read the Western press, that's how it's being portrayed, as he's calling for the opening of more humanitarian aid corridors and the upping of aid into Syria. You know, it just so happens that the humanitarian king, Antony Blinken, is calling for the aid corridors, which lead directly into northeastern Syria, to be opened most urgently. And that's where the United States just so happens to have a few hundred of its forces. And of course, its allies, the Kurdish SDF, operating and holds the country. And of course, it is the United States, and Antony Blinken was part of this in the Obama administration, that helped start this war, backing al-Qaeda-linked groups. And of course, in this meeting as well, we saw a lot of attention on northwestern Syria, which is controlled by a group, primarily this group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And they are an offshoot, essentially the name has just changed, of Shabath al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, essentially. Whilst this was ongoing and we saw a lot of talk about the humanitarian situation in Syria, we saw relatively no talk whatsoever about the sanctions regime, that's the CSER Act. They said over the past year, the humanitarian situation has grown in extremely dire. It's got a lot worse. But it was last year, in fact, in June, when the CSER Act was first put into action. And so it's only natural that this has happened in the country, and yet we're not hearing anything. In fact, it was only the Syrian and Russian representatives in the Security Council that even mentioned the sanctions.
Indeed, you wouldn't be at all suggesting that the two things are linked, would you, Robert? I mean, perish the thought. Quick trawl through social media, please.
The first reaction we have here states that the United States waged a decade-long proxy war against Syria, is occupying large swathes of its territory, stealing its oil, wheat supplies, and imposing sanctions so severe millions of Syrians are going hungry. And this piece of garbage has the goal to talk about humanitarian aid. It's depraved. We've got another one here as well, another strong response from Todd, who says, when Syria refused to have the pipeline bisect their nation, the United States organized and funded terrorists and imposed sanctions. Humanitarian aid does not come with strings nor conditions. Humanitarians do not impose complicity with siege warfare.
All right, strong words to leave it on. Robert Inakesh, thank you. Now, pious Muslim women across Europe are finding life more difficult amid growing Islamophobia. Switzerland became the most recent country to ban the niqab on the continent, forcing Muslim women to give up a key aspect of their faith by force. Now, what impact does this state-backed anti-Islam law have on women's lives? Well, Robert Carter followed up the story and filed this report.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticized burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act. And I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you, I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal, so it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great, yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere, the defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve.
The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
France's foreign minister has cranked up further pressure on Lebanese leaders to form a working government, urging them in personal phone calls for an immediate halt to what he called deliberate obstruction. Earlier in the week, Jean-Yves Le Drian called Lebanese President Michel Aoun, Acting Prime Minister Saad Hariri, and Parliamentary Speaker Nabi Berri, and called for an end to the 7 months of political deadlock that's driven the country toward collapse. The latest rounds of talks between Aoun and Hariri collapsed last week. Disagreements over the shape and size of a new cabinet continue to block any progress. Lebanon is currently facing its worst economic crisis in modern history, a situation exacerbated by pandemic restrictions and last year's explosion at Beirut's port. It's the event that reignited the Black Lives Matter movement last summer in the U.S. and across the globe. Derek Chauvin, the white police officer who knelt on the body of African-American George Floyd, is finally in the docks with the eyes of the world on his every move, on his every statement. Richard Sudan's been closely following this one online. It's disturbing already, Richard.
And it's disturbing many people around the world who are keeping an eye on proceedings, having seen the event take place in May of last year. Now, there's been massive protests taking place outside the courthouse where proceedings are happening. And on the second day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, we've seen some very emotional and graphic testimony from witnesses that have been called to the stand. Now, we've heard one testimony from one witness named Donald Williams, who talked about the life draining away from George Floyd's eyes, the life visibly draining away from his face as Derek Chauvin knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes. And he talked about the fact that George Floyd was quite clearly not resisting arrest. And this witness flatly referred to the actions of Derek Chauvin as murder, which of course chimes and resonates with how most people around the world really saw this event transpire. We saw another witness talk about the fact that viewing the footage of the incident taking place in real time, that Derek Chauvin knelt on the neck of George Floyd for so long that she actually thought the video footage had actually frozen. The scenes were that serious. And actually, one of the things which is really catching people's attention and which people are incredulous about is the fact that the defense is arguing that Derek Chauvin used reasonable force and was following police protocol and procedures. Millions of people around the world really don't view it this way, Amina. Derek Chauvin is facing two counts of murder, one count of manslaughter, and people are already skeptical about whether or not they'll see a conviction. And of course, the actual reality in the United States, I'm afraid for many people, is that even if Derek Chauvin goes to prison, for there to be a real precedent set which would actually see systemic change in the United States, there are numbers and there are many, many police officers, critics would say, that simply need to be jailed for the killing of black people while they wear police uniforms and mean. So the whole world is watching this trial, and we've seen very emotional testimonies indeed.
Social media for us. Can you choose your favourite two tweets on this topic for me, Richard?
Let's go first to Bishop Talbot Swan, who says, which one of you who are swearing that Derek Chauvin's actions had nothing to do with George Floyd's death are willing to lay handcuffed on the ground and allow a grown man to kneel on your neck with his full weight for 9 minutes to demonstrate how harmless that is? I'll wait. And we have a reaction also from Daniel, who says, if they don't do the right thing in the Derek Chauvin trial, it seems reasonable to expect that major response activities will take place. George Floyd was absolutely intentionally murdered. Floyd mattered and still does, and thousands upon thousands of other victims do too.
All right, we'll move on to another story, controversial for different reasons, Richard.
Indeed. So Ghislaine Maxwell, the confidant, partner, and some would say collaborator with Jeffrey Epstein, is facing sex trafficking charges. Now, of course, Jeffrey Epstein was accused of running perhaps most the wide-reaching and elaborate abuse ring possibly in history, many people are saying. And, of course, Ghislaine Maxwell was a key figure in that. Now, she's facing charges. We'll see where this goes. Of course, Epstein actually died in New York Correctional Facility in the summer of 2019. The official reason was, of course, suicide, but many people actually say that he was murdered in order to prevent him testifying and releasing information on a lot of people. And some people would say Prince Andrew is one of the people that potentially would have had the lid lifted on his activities. And so, of course, this trial and these charges are about Ghislaine Maxwell, but really this is about the number of people that were potentially implicated in this abuse ring ran by Jeffrey Epstein. And actually, Amina, some people say that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were Israeli spies. That's what a lot of people online are certainly saying. So, you know, this kind of move is welcome, if you like. But I'm afraid for a lot of people, the fact that Jeffrey Epstein will never take the stand will probably, some might say, mean that many other people potentially implicated in this massive, massive crime will never face full accountability for their actions. Of course, Prince Andrew was famously pictured with Virginia Giuffre, who was allegedly trafficked with Ghislaine Maxwell, literally in the picture. And of course, the famous interview took place with Prince Andrew, where he denied virtually all of the questions that were put to him.
Despite some of that photographic evidence. Wow. Richard Sudan, thank you. And thank you so much for being with us for this edition of The Bulletin. Until next time.
In the limelight.
In what many Palestinians have described as a continuation of the Nakba, that is Israel's 1948 ethnic cleansing campaign in Palestine, the Zionist regime is currently in the process of expelling thousands of Palestinians from East Al-Quds under the pretext of preservation. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Jessica Boxbaum, an Al-Quds-based journalist for Midpress News, covering Palestine, occupied territories, and Syria under the heading, An Old Green Colonial Trick, Israel Masking Land Grabs as Environmental Conservation. Please stay with us to hear more about the issue. For decades, a Palestinian village on the southern tip of Al-Quds has lived on and cultivated the land. But a series of recent efforts by the Israeli regime is not only threatening their way of life, but potentially displacing them from their homes. On January 25th, Al-Quds District Planning Committee rejected the residents of Palestinian village Al-Walaja's plan to legalize their homes and further develop the community. Instead, the committee declared their land an ancient agricultural area in need of environmental conservation that should be transformed into a national park. The notion of environmental integrity struck Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at the Israeli nonprofit Er Amim, as contradictory. Cohen said the planning committee and the Israeli civil administration within the West Bank have been promoting and advancing plans within the same area for illegal Jewish settlers, adding, "It shows massive discrimination in how Israel treats Palestinian areas in order to suppress the residential development." The committee's decision paves the way for the lifting of the demolition freeze on 38 Al-Walaja's home. On April 26, Israel's Supreme Court will convene for a hearing on Al-Walaja 2018 petition over its resident-initiated outline plan. Ibrahim Araj, 37, grew up in Al-Walaja. The home he built for his family in 2016 is now under threat of demolition. Araj expects the court will not rule in Al-Walaja's favor in April, and his house will be demolished. Referring to the planning committee's rejection of the development plan for environmental reason, Araj said, "It's not logical or legal," adding,